Well, hey, we are in Exodus chapter 7. We are finally going to do it this morning. This is everything up to this point has been leading up to this moment. We're going to get into the what we often refer to as the 10 plagues. So today we're looking at turning the Nile into blood. But one of the things that I've been challenged with recently as we've been going through this, and I shared this with Dustin a while back, we always refer to these 10 things that happen as the 10 plagues. And that's not inappropriate because at least three times in the Exodus story, chapter 9, 11, and 12, it does use the word plague to refer to them. But more specifically, God refers to these as my signs and wonders. In fact, more often. And I think that's important because plagues indicate sort of this punishment aspect of it, you know? But it was more than that. That wasn't the primary intent to what God is going to do. The real primary intent was to reveal himself as Yahweh to all of Egypt, to Pharaoh, to the Israelites, and to humiliate the gods of Egypt. And he says he's going to do that through his signs and his wonders, that that's what they would see. And so you'll hear us refer to them as signs and wonders. You'll hear us refer to them as plagues. Partly, in fact, I went in this morning on my outline a couple of times and I just crossed out the word plague because that's habit. But I do want us to keep in mind that this is more than just plagues. It's really God's signs and wonders that he's doing, demonstrating his awesomeness, his sovereignty. And as we saw, that he's Yahweh, which I believe is not just about his eternal existence. I think it's about his eternal existence, his sovereignty, his power, his authority, but also his presence with his people. So anyway, we'll do our best to kind of walk through those. You'll hear us talk about plagues. You'll hear us talk about signs and wonders. But really, the emphasis is on God's signs and wonders. Something that's revealed repeatedly throughout Exodus is that the purpose of these signs, again, were not just to force Pharaoh and Egypt to let his people go. I kind of broke it down into maybe three primary, this isn't our outline per se, but I think there's kind of three primary purposes here. One of them was, we find that God's overarching purpose in a lot of this was to reveal to Israel who he was. And we see that Deuteronomy chapter 4, you don't have to turn there, but Deuteronomy chapter 4, he tells us that that's when he's revealing himself to Israel so that they might know him. We have to remember that Israel really didn't know who God was anymore. Joshua tells us that they were worshiping the pagan gods of Egypt. We know that when they went out into the wilderness, they want to make a calf, and they, you know, we're told elsewhere that they worshiped the gods of Egypt. And so one of the things we'll find in this is that God's purpose was to tell Israel who he was and to reintroduce himself as Yahweh to them. Also in Deuteronomy, we find that he was going to reveal to Israel's enemies in the future what he could do. So in doing these signs and wonders, he was demonstrating to Israel the power and authority he has over the false gods, over kings and rulers, over nature. And he tells Israel a little bit later in the book of Deuteronomy that they should reflect on those things and realize, I'll do this to your enemies too, going forward. And so it was given to them to sort of build confidence that going forward, this is what God would do to their enemies. Think about it. You know, a small little people group, if we can call them that, maybe 2 million people, but really they're not soldiers, and yet they're going to go up into a land that has kings and kingdoms and fierce fighters. And in fact, when we look at the route that they actually took, God routed them past the Philistines because the Philistines were pretty formidable army. And so when he let them out, one of the first things he did was kind of bypass the Philistines. They weren't ready to face them. And so we're going to see that as a second thing as well. But a third thing that we see throughout this is that God is going to use these signs and wonders to just completely humiliate the gods of Egypt. In fact, I'll let you go ahead and turn there because it's just in the same book. But Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, just look at what he says. This is talking about the 10th signs and wonder, the 10th plague with the killing of the firstborn. But he says in verse 12 of chapter 12, "For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, will strike down the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." That's repeated in the book of Numbers as well, Numbers 33, that God says, remember what I did in Egypt? I humiliated all of their gods. And so why that's important is because each one of these signs and wonders that God does, these 10 plagues, They all target specific gods in Egypt, oftentimes many gods. And when we see them in that light, it becomes really clear that what God is doing is he's basically telling these Israelites who have been worshiping these Egyptian gods for a couple of hundred years, they are nothing, and I'm Yahweh. And so he shows his power and authority over them, and he never mentions them by name, but I'm going to mention names, because we know who some of these gods are. There were as many as 2,000. I'll highlight a couple of names here and there as we go through the different signs and wonders that God performs. So Egypt was a polytheistic nation, hundreds if not thousands of gods, and each one of these is designed to sort of attack those gods. Remember the first sign last week? It was at the end of the passage where Moses and Aaron go in and they use the staff. And what happens when they throw that staff down on the ground? Turns into a snake, right? And then what happens when the magicians come in and they do the same thing? They turn into snakes, right? And what does Aaron's staff do? Eats them up, right? Well, snakes were an extremely important part of Egypt and their religious symbolism. The main snake god, I'm going to try to pronounce some of these, but Nehebaku, I think is one way to pronounce it. According to Egyptian mythology, that particular snake god swallowed up 7 cobras, and that made him the premier snake god. Now, do you remember anything about some of the imagery with the pharaohs? Did you ever notice how they have the cobra on the top there? That was that god. And it was a sign of deity. It was sort of their chief serpent god, if you will. There was a second prominent snake god named Wajet. It was a goddess. And she was the most often the one actually... I believe she was the one that was portrayed as the upstanding cobra in here, not the other god. But anyway, Aaron's staff, by swallowing up those other snakes, demonstrated what? God's superiority over them. So he starts with that most prominent symbol of that cobra, you know, and Aaron's staff just swallows them right up. Right out of the gate, God says, I'm better than they are, I'm bigger than they are, I'm more powerful than they are, those snakes are nothing. And so we'll see that kind of followed out through some of these things. In our passage today, we come to the first of these 10 signs and wonders that God orchestrated against Pharaoh in Egypt. And it involves the Nile River. Now, why is that important? The Nile River was critical in ancient Egypt because, if you know, most of Egypt was desert, dry land. The Nile was their primary water source, and it basically connected the northern fertile region to the southern area that was pretty fertile. And so most of Egypt kind of lived in the north in the fertile area, and the south in the bottom part, and then all along that Nile River, because that provided their life in many respects. Most of that population, as they lived along, that would rely on certain things as it came to that, that Nile, because, for instance, all their agriculture. The fish in the Nile were the primary source of protein for Egyptians. Remember how they kind of despised shepherds? Most of them didn't want to be shepherds. Most of their protein came from fish. And so they relied on the Nile for their protein. They did rely on it for agriculture. In fact, they looked forward to the annual flooding because as it would overflow the sides, it would go out into the fields. And that's how they basically watered their crops. And so the Nile was the lifeblood of Egypt. All the little tributaries and other things that kind of fed into it. But because of that, there was also a significant amount of religious heritage and worship and other things related to the Nile itself. In fact, they considered the Nile to be divine itself. Not necessarily a god, but divine. They had a number of gods associated with it. We'll touch on these a little bit later. But they believed that these gods controlled the Nile, controlled fertility related to the Nile. So when the Nile flooded, they attributed that to a god. When the Nile didn't flood and they expected it to, they attributed that to the gods being angry. And so there's a tremendous amount of religious symbolism and belief that all surrounds this Nile. It was the lifeblood of Egypt. And so God starts with that. He's going to go right at the jugular. So let's go ahead and break this down. I'm going to break the passage down into 4 sections today. The first one is that God warned Pharaoh about the consequences of his sin. That's going to be in verses 14 through 18. Let's just read that briefly here. Verses 14 through 17. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water, and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. Why do you suppose God had him take that staff? It's a reminder of what he had already done with the cobras. That becomes the sign of God's power and authority through Moses. We're going to see him use it a couple other times. You shall say to him, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, 'Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness.' But behold, you have not listened until now." And that means, not that he's listening now, but that up until this point you haven't listened. "Thus says the Lord, Yahweh, 'By this you shall know that I am Yahweh. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile and the staff that is in my hand, and it will be turned to blood. The fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find it difficult in drinking water from the Nile.' Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the streams, and over the pools, and over all the reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there will be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and vessels of stone.'" And so the first thing we see here is that God warns Pharaoh about the consequences of his sin and not letting his people go. The text here tells us that Pharaoh's heart was stubborn. Other translations use words like it was hard, it was unyielding, even it was unresponsive. What we're going to see throughout these episodes here is there's going to be this repetition of this word hardened in most English translations. In fact, there's 19 references in our English Bible to it. It's going to talk about the Pharaoh's heart being hard. It's going to say that the Pharaoh hardened his heart. It's going to say Yahweh hardened the Pharaoh's heart. And you're going to see this weird interaction. Sometimes it just says his heart is hard. Sometimes it says the Pharaoh hardened his heart. Sometimes it says the Lord hardened his heart. And all of these things are important. But the other thing that's kind of important about this is that there are different words that are used too. And we're going to try to make sure that we present those appropriately. Dustin's over here smiling. It's kind of a fascinating study. There are three different words that are used for hardening, or in this case, the NASB's translation of stubborn is one of those words. One of them is only used one time, and it's used here. And it basically refers to this idea that his heart is just plain hard and unlistening. But there's two other words that are used, and they kind of go back and forth. The second one is the word that's most commonly referred to. It's translated as hardened, but it generally means a stiffening or making something firm. And the idea that's communicated in the story of Exodus is this idea of resolve, meaning that the Pharaoh sort of developed a spine to oppose God. His heart was hard in the sense, not that he didn't listen, but that he was puffing out his chest and he was going to basically be able to survive these plagues. And that becomes important because God doesn't want him to stop after the first plague. God wants to go through all 10 of these things for a reason. And so the text is going to tell us that the Lord gives Pharaoh the ability to withstand these plagues. And I think when you think about it, the number of these things, Pharaoh should have given up after the first one. Definitely after the second one. Most certainly after the third. But he doesn't. He doesn't give up until the 10th. And why is that? The text is going to tell us that the Lord strengthened his heart. That's what he means by he hardened it. He gave Pharaoh the resolve to withstand what he was going to go through. Now, it's a hard concept for us to understand, but it's something that God does. The other word that's used is this word that means to be heavy. That his heart was made heavy, or that his heart was heavy. Actually, I'm sorry, I made a statement that the word that was used here is the idea of being hard. That was used earlier. This word that's used right here is the word for heavy. And why is that important? I want you to think about something here. A more literal translation here in verse 14 would be that the Pharaoh's heart was heavy, or heavy is the Pharaoh's heart. Why is that important? It's a declaration of sin and condemnation, and why is that? The Egyptians believed in something called the 42 negative confessions. When a Pharaoh would die and he was embalmed, they took out all of the organs but left one organ. Anybody know what that organ was? The heart. And why did they leave the heart in that body? Because the Pharaoh needed it in the next life, but in the next life, that heart would be weighed against a feather. Against a feather. There was a god called Maat, the goddess of truth. And so in the afterlife, what the Egyptians believed was that the pharaoh would have to go stand before a council of gods. And the feather of Maat, the goddess of truth, would be put on the scale. And the pharaoh's heart would be put on the other side of the scale. And then 42 confessions would have to be made by that pharaoh. And those confessions were all negative. I did not do this. I was not this way. And all of those things were sin-related. I didn't lie. I didn't cheat. I didn't deceive. And after going through those 42 negative confessions, but all the sin he didn't commit, this council of gods would judge whether or not he was being truthful. And the way they determined that was if his heart weighed less than the feather, he was innocent. But if his heart was heavy, weighed more than the feather, he was guilty. And what do you suppose happened in the afterlife with that? He's guilty. The afterlife is going to be a very terrible thing for him. And so think about that for a moment. Moses is going to Pharaoh here and basically says his heart is heavy with sin. That's just not a statement about, oh, he's got a hard heart. It's he is guilty of sin, and he's using language that not only Moses, but the Hebrews and even the Pharaoh would understand. That is a catastrophic thing for a Pharaoh to have a heart that is heavy with sin, because that condemns him in the afterlife. No Pharaoh would want to hear that. No Pharaoh would want to have a heavy heart. And so that's right out of the gate. God comes out and he says, Pharaoh's guilty. His heart is heavy. He is condemned in the afterlife. That is a pretty bold statement. And so that leads into then his discussion with the Pharaoh. What is he guilty of? Well, let's look at verses 15 through 18. God gives him this message here. He basically says, go down and meet him at the Nile. Now, why would he meet him at the Nile? We're not really sure, but we assume that it's because the Pharaoh was going down to cleanse himself. There's another verse a few chapters later where he does the same thing. It seems to be a regular practice that he would go down and he would bathe himself. Much like probably the Pharaoh's daughter when she found Moses. So he's going down there, so Moses knows his routine. It was probably every few days, maybe been a weekly thing, we're not really sure. But he goes down there and he says, go position yourself and go talk to him. So I believe he was down there probably bathing himself. And he tells him, Moses, take your staff with you. Why? That's the authority, if you will, a symbolic authority. And take it with you. And then we find out that the Lord tells him to lay out the charges against him. So you look back at verse 16. Say to him, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you have not listened. Remember what we've said about that word listen? It means you haven't obeyed. You haven't done what I told you to do. And so the charges, God said, I told you what to do and you didn't do it. That's why his heart is heavy. Now, there's many other reasons why his heart is heavy. So Pharaoh didn't listen to him. So then, what's next? The Lord declares to him the consequence of that. Because of this, what happens? Well, it says in verse 17, thus says Yahweh, by this you shall know that I am Yahweh. Behold, I will strike the water in the Nile with the staff that's in my hand, and it will be turned to blood. That's the consequence. Pharaoh, Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, God told you to let the people go. You refused. Because you've got a heavy heart. You're guilty of sin. But because you didn't listen, I'm going to take this staff. I'm going to touch the water. It's going to turn to blood. So that's the consequence of sin. God announced it beforehand. Isn't that interesting how God does that? It's not like he just expects us to figure it out. We know the Bible makes it really clear that there are consequences for sin. That's the way God operates. That's actually part of his mercy. You know, same thing with your kids. You know, when we raised our kids, we found it really difficult to discipline our kids when we knew that they didn't know what those limits were, what the things were supposed to be. And so if they did something that they shouldn't have done, we were always careful. You know what? We can't discipline them in the sense of spanking them or consequences. But we made it clear, okay, going forward now. And so in my head, if Katie or Kimberly did something, I'd have to say, well, did I communicate that to them? Should they have known? God's that way. And so he did that with Pharaoh here. I don't think we can overlook what God was about to do here. It wasn't just to punish Pharaoh. It wasn't just an act of revenge. In fact, if you look at verse 17, the reason why he does this, by this you will know that I am Yahweh. That's really the purpose of this. I am going to now discipline you. I'm going to judge you. I'm going to turn your Nile to blood. Not just to get back at you, not just to punish you, not just to hurt you, so that you might know that I'm Yahweh. That's the goal. He repeats this over a dozen times in the book of Exodus, so that you might know I'm Yahweh, so that you might know I'm Yahweh. That's the goal. That's the purpose. God revealing himself. So while Psalm 19 tells us he reveals himself in the heavens, in creation, he reveals himself in his word, God also reveals himself in his judgments and his discipline, so that we might know who he is. And that's the primary purpose here. Now, it is to ultimately release Israel and deliver them. But even above that, God is revealing himself to a pagan, polytheistic nation and to Israel who had fallen into that same trap. So what's our takeaway with something like this? Well, really simply, there's consequences for sin. But they're not without purpose. They're designed by God to reveal who he is and ultimately lead us to a healthy fear and reverence of him. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Jump down into verse 4. He says, "You've not resisted yet to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin." Which, in other words, you got to work harder at striving against sin. "And you've forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard," this is a quote from Proverbs, "My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons, for what son is there whom the father does not discipline? But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers who discipline us, and we respect them." That's the point. They discipline us, and we respect them. That's God's purpose too. He disciplines so that we might respect him. "Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of light, or Father of spirits, and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, so that we may share his holiness." I'm just going to stop there. That's the point. That's the purpose. It isn't just to punish. And we have to keep that in mind as we look at these plagues. I think the world, as they read this, just sort of sees it as God being a vengeful God, stomping down the Egyptians. But it was more than that. It was God revealing himself as Yahweh, which, think about it, that's the only way anybody can get saved, is it not? They have to know God is God. I think this reveals God's heart for the Egyptians, believe it or not, that they might know me, because he tells us that a number of times, that they might know I'm Yahweh. And God partly does that through warning the Pharaoh about the consequences of his sin and what's about to happen. So what happens next? Well, the obvious, God demonstrates his sovereign control, I'm going to say it this way, over the gods of the Nile. I could have said God punished him. But I think it's more than that. He did punish him. We're going to see that here. But ultimately, at this point, I believe God was demonstrating his sovereign control over the Egyptian gods who were thought to control the Nile. Look at verses 19 through 21. Go back to chapter 7 in Exodus, 19 through 21. "Then Yahweh said to Moses, 'Say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over the rivers, over the streams, over the pools, and over all the reservoirs of water, that they may become blood. And there will be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and vessels of stone. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. And he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile, in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. All the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. The fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile. And the blood was throughout all the land of Egypt. This was catastrophic. Remember, that Nile is the lifeblood of Egypt. With the exception of the Nile Valley in this northern delta area, most of them lived right along that route. If they didn't have the Nile, all they had was desert. It was their main source of drinking water, their main source of irrigation, again, their main source of protein in their diet. Without the Nile, they couldn't eat. They couldn't drink. They wouldn't be able to survive, for the most part. All of that was impacted. There's no drinking water. There's no irrigation. There's fish. Would anybody eat it? It's all dead, rotten, stinky. This has been probably more of a phenomenon in the last probably couple of centuries. To say that what God had done here was just simply natural. You know, they're always looking for natural means for how God works. And He does sometimes. I have no doubt about that. But they want to say, well, no, what happened here at the Nile was just, there's a bunch of red clay. And as the waters washed down into the Nile, they brought all this red clay with them. And that's really what happened. It really wasn't blood. God really didn't turn the Nile into blood. Even though it's what it says. Now, granted, there are times where sometimes literal language like this is meant to be taken figuratively. And that's what they'll say with this. It wasn't real blood. It was this red clay. They'll also suggest that, well, maybe it was a certain type of algae. There is a certain type of algae that has a red tinge to it that's common in that area. So maybe this was just red algae. It's kind of an algae bloom. You know, Amy and I, our favorite place to visit is Grand Cayman. And last year when we went there, I was concerned because of the, what's that algae red? Oh, it was terrible. But fortunately, it wasn't there when we were there. It's not a common thing down there. But I've been watching recently, seeing people post, where is it? Is it over on 7 Mile Beach? You know, but the stuff just stinks and it's just not enjoyable. Okay, so maybe it was just this algae, right? And you know, the fish died because of the lack of oxygen in the water then. But you know, really this doesn't fit the context. Think about this for a moment. Water washing down and dragging clay with it doesn't happen in an instant. Fish dying and stinking doesn't happen in an instant. Moses walks over, takes his staff, or Aaron does, and what happens? Not only the Nile, the rivers, the streams, the pools, the reservoir. The reason I also believe it wasn't red clay or algae is because the pots that they had in their house turned to blood. This wasn't some natural consequence that God just manipulated. Plus, think about this for a second. How much would that really say about God if they're standing there going, Moses, it's just algae. It's just clay. We see it all the time. No, this was a supernatural act. This was not a normal thing. Now, is there red clay there? Some parts. Is there algae there? Sometimes. But not like this. Not where all of the water related to the Nile. And that's the key here. It wasn't just the Nile. It was any water that had been associated with the Nile at all. Any rivers or streams connected to it, any reservoirs that they had put water into, any jar they had in their house, any water that came out of that Nile was blood. That's what happened. Supernatural act. Now, what were the gods that were maybe targeted by this? I'll just touch on that before we go any further. Remember, God is demonstrating His power and authority over these gods. One god was Osiris. That was the god of fertility, vegetation, and agriculture. The Nile was considered to be His bloodline, His veins. So the Nile, with all its tributaries, those were His veins and His bloodline. That was Osiris. He watered the crops. He provided drinking water for them. Another god named Happy wasn't so happy at this point, H-A-P-I. He was the main deity of the Nile. He was responsible for flooding every year, which means he controlled all the flooding. So whenever it would flood, that was Happy. They'd go out and do their sacrifices to Happy. They'd go to their temples to Happy. They would praise Happy for bringing the floods. And when it didn't flood and they needed it to, they would go out and they would beg Happy to be happy and to make the floods. Another one of the gods that was associated with this was a god named Num, K-H-N-U-M. He was considered to be the source of the Nile, meaning it wasn't his blood, but he kind of directed it. It kind of came out of him. And so this weird connection between three gods, and that's the way that the Egyptians were. It wouldn't always just be one god. It was a couple of different gods that were all sort of associated with the same thing. And part of the reason for that is they all competed. The gods competed against each other for superiority in a particular area. And so while one of these gods was considered to be his veins, another god was considered to be the source, they might compete. It's kind of a weird thing within Egyptian polytheism. What would be our takeaway with this? Why is this important that God is demonstrating his superiority over these Egyptian gods? One is because they worshiped them. They gave them all the glory for what God was responsible for. God was the God of the Nile. God was the God of their rivers and streams. And God was the God of their agriculture. And God was the one that provided the fish. The Bible tells us that. There's a thing called common grace. Even though they're pagans and they don't deserve to breathe, God in his common grace still allows humankind to be fed, to receive rain, to survive. All the glory is supposed to go to him. But the Egyptians didn't do that. They attributed it to somebody else. Romans chapter 1, Dustin looked at this. They looked at creation, and instead of recognizing and worshiping the Creator, what did they do? Worship the creation. And the Egyptians worshiped the Nile, the water of the Nile, and the associated gods. And so what's our takeaway with this? I think it's pretty simple. There's only one true God. We know that as Christians. And he is a jealous God. And he actually demands, doesn't ask, demands that we don't worship any other gods. That's the big one, isn't it? Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods, what? Before me. Do we need to be reminded of that as Christians? Technically, theologically, probably not. Right? I don't think anybody here believes in other gods, do they? I mean, I'm not talking demons. I'm just, really? I mean, you don't go home and say, well, you know, there is God, and then maybe tomorrow, Tuesday, I go see somebody else. Now, I'm being facetious here, but the reality of it is, do we ever behave maybe like there are other gods? Are there other things maybe we worship sometimes? Are there other things maybe we attribute to chance or that really we ought to be going, no, God, that was you. You know? So I think a good takeaway for us is that what God really wants is for us to recognize him as the true God that is provider of everything. Every good thing. James says that every good thing and every perfect gift, what? Comes from God. The Egyptians didn't recognize that. And in fact, the Israelites didn't recognize that. Even the Israelites thought many of these things came from the other Egyptian gods. And God was saying, no. Mm-mm. It's me. I'm the one true God. I'm not asking you. I'm telling you not to have any other gods before me. And so I think it's a good takeaway for us, even as Christians, just to remember, you know what? Our hearts ought to be completely devoted to one God. Sometimes we aim to talk about this because it's common in Nuthetic counseling ministries, the idols of the heart, which are idols, things we worship sometimes. We don't give God glory and honor for certain things when we should, and instead, it's like we're worshiping other gods. Except in this case here, the Israelites and the Egyptians were actually worshiping other gods, and it would be something that would plague them going forward into the land of Canaan. Now, let's move on. What happens next? Well, I'm going to phrase it this way. Yahweh allowed counterfeit works of the magicians to harden Pharaoh's heart even further. Look at verses 22 through 23. But the magicians of Egypt did the same thing with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. Now, I refer to the works of the magicians here as counterfeits because I don't believe they were supernaturally able to turn water into blood like God had done. In other words, what happens? They go in, Moses and Aaron drop that staff in the water, all of a sudden everything is red, it's instantaneous, and so Pharaoh says, "Hey, idiots, get in here. You guys are supposed to do something with this, aren't you?" And so they do their magic stuff, you know, and all of a sudden, ooh, they did. You know, they probably had a bucket of water. They didn't go out to the Nile and turn the Nile was already red with blood. So they took some water and they did their little magic stuff, and look, it's red. Maybe they stuck clay in it. But they mimicked what God, and we know that because it says, with their secret arts. That phrase is literally secret, is literally a form, a plural form of the word for secrecy. They did it with their secrecies. It's deception. It's mimicry. They didn't really turn it into blood. The text tells us they did it with their secret arts, their sleight of hand. The same phrase is used of the magicians three other times with the snakes, with the frogs, and with the gnats. Now, when it got to the bigger things, they couldn't even come close to pretending, mimicking it. And so that's literally what's happening here, is they're just mimicking what God had done, and that implies, it tells us, there's no supernatural abilities that they had to do it. They did not change anything truly into blood. They were simply using their secrecy, their illusions, their sleight of hand, just like magicians do today. I love, as much, you know, Penn and Teller, you guys may be familiar with them, magicians. They're atheists, but they've got a tremendous amount of respect for Christians who share their faith, because they're like, if you really believe people are going to hell, you ought to share your faith, you know. But it's interesting, I kind of watch their show that they do where they have this thing called Fool Us, and they bring these magicians on, and they attempt to fool Penn and Teller. And so then Penn and Teller will watch them, and then when it's all done, Penn and Teller will try to figure out how it was done, and then Penn, the one that, is it Penn that talks? Yeah, Teller's one that's quiet. So Penn will then talk, and he talks in code, so that he can reveal to the magician, yeah, we know how you did it, but the audience doesn't know how it was done. But the one thing I kind of appreciate about Penn and Teller is they hate mentalists who try to convince people they really have ability to read minds. They just find that like so deceptive. So when they do their stuff, they just tell people, all right, this is a trick. We don't have magic powers. And they hate magicians that try to convince you that they do have some type of magical powers, because they're like, nope. And so they go out of there, and I kind of appreciate that, you know? This is a case where we've been told here they used their secrecies. And I believe that what they're doing here is they're really mimicking what's going on. Others may disagree with me. I think that's what's going on here. Especially since, you notice, if they really had supernatural abilities, why didn't they just go over to the Nile and turn it back into water? Why didn't they just go to the streams, turn it back into water? If they were really supernatural, if they really could do it. But they didn't. So these counterfeit acts, look at what they resulted in. And I think this is important. It says, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened. The Hebrew word that's used there is the one that means to strengthen. So the first one was that it was heavy with sin. This one is, no, his heart was now strengthened. What does it mean in this case? It means that he developed some resolve. And we see that here because what does he do? It says it was hardened and he didn't listen to them, Moses and Aaron. Didn't listen to what Yahweh had said. In fact, look at the callousness here. He turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. This is the lifeblood of Egypt. And what does he do? Turns around and walks back into his house. No concern. So what? He had become stubborn. His heart was hardened with, I'm going to say, resolve. Have you ever seen that before where somebody's involved with sin? They get confronted, but instead of expressing remorse, they double down? happens all the time. In fact, I've been watching some stuff online recently about what's going on in the whole Bethel, Hillsong, NAR. It's basically hyper-Pentecostal circles with the cover-up culture. There's a guy by the name of Mike Winger who's been doing some long videos, 6 hours, 4 hours, basically showing that much of what happens right now in the Bethel and Hillsong with their prophets and all that, they're doing data mining. He's literally shown where, you know, Sean Bowles will be on stage and he'll be prophesying to people, you know, saying, "Oh, is there a Susie here with the birth date of this? And I see that you love to sing." Well, then they show, "Oh, this is all on their Facebook." And the way they figured this out is because those same people registered on the, like, when the conference was set up and they registered to go, well, now Sean Bowles is going on there and going, "I see this person's registered and I see they have a Facebook profile." I go to their Facebook profile, he writes it all down because he reads this off his phone. And they've demonstrated this is all fake. Absolutely just fake. And when confronted, they puff up their chest, they have more resolve instead of expressing remorse. And that's exactly what happens here. He turns and he goes into his house. It says he didn't even set his heart on this. That's callousness. But it's not only callousness, he's developing a resolve to now stand up. And part of that's understandable from his perspective because, remember, they considered themselves, Pharaoh's considered themselves divine. And remember what he said elsewhere? I think it was chapter 5. "Who is this Yahweh? I don't know this Yahweh. And besides, why would I listen to him?" And so now we find that Pharaoh basically putting his feet down. "I'm not going to listen to him. I'm not going to recognize him. Who's he to tell me what to do? I don't care if he's turned the Nile to blood. My magicians can do that. It's just a trick. Your God is just using a trick." That's basically what it amounts to. So what would our takeaway be with this? I think, you know, there's all kinds of counterfeits in this world. Think about from a religious perspective. There's New Age practices, there's emotional experiences, there's false teachers, there's unbiblical doctrines, there's even demonic practices. All of which are designed to deceive us and harden our hearts, aren't they? That's the purpose. It's all just designed to draw us away from God and to harden our hearts against Him. Every counterfeit is that way. And there's again, tons of them. Philippians chapter 4, turn there with me. This is just a simple passage, but Philippians chapter 4. After Paul wrote to the Philippians that they should pray, not to be anxious, and he tells them to kind of guard their hearts, or he says the peace of God will guard their hearts, which is the idea of protecting, but then he goes on immediately into just the next verse, Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. He says this, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is good repute, if there's any excellence, and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things." Things that you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. That would have been some good advice for Pharaoh. But instead, worshiping other gods, hardening and stiffening his heart, thinking maybe he can outlast this God. But I think it's good for us as well that we just keep in mind that there's so many counterfeits and other things that can draw our attention away from just the simple truth of God and His Word. And in many respects, we can kind of become like Pharaoh, harden our hearts, stiffen our resolve, especially when it comes to sin, since none of us like to be confronted. Let's look at one last piece here. The very last thing that I see here is this. Even in the midst of all of this, God exercised compassion in the midst of this. Did you catch that? It's really sort of subtle. Go back to chapter 7, verses 24 and 25. It says, "So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink the water of the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile." Now, why is that important? They were able to dig. Must be like wells possibly here. God still provided them with an opportunity to have water. Had they not been able to do that, there was no water that they could drink. It was all blood. They couldn't have fish. They couldn't eat. So God did allow. He didn't take all the water in Egypt because they were still able to dig. This is near. It was probably groundwater. God allowed that. He didn't completely take away their right to, or their ability, I shouldn't say, their ability to survive. That's an element, I think, of mercy and grace. They had to work for it. The other thing that's kind of interesting, the plague appears to have only lasted 7 days. The reason I say that is, it says here, 7 full days passed after Yahweh had struck the Nile. And at first glance, that might appear to simply mean that struck the Nile, and then 7 days later, chapter 8, verse 1 happens. And there's an element of truth to that. Then the Lord said to Moses. So, in other words, God waited 7 days. But the phrase itself is kind of interesting in that it's more literally 7 days were fulfilled. Which some, and I think I probably lean in this direction, that the plague itself was complete, was done after 7 days. Now, I don't know that we can be dogmatic about that, but it appears to be the case. They go on for another few months here. They could not have survived for months and months if all that water was blood, no agriculture. And the fact that you have cattle and you have crops that are destroyed implies that the Nile was returned back to water at some point. And so I look at this phrase here when it says that the 7 days were fulfilled is probably a reference to the fact that God lifted that after 7 days. And why is that important? Because again, I think it shows God is merciful and compassionate, even in His judgment. You know, Romans tells us that the kindness of God leads us to repentance. We find out elsewhere, as we read earlier this morning, that God chastises us. You know, it's like He doesn't just snuff us out. No, one on strike, you're out. He disciplines us. He lets us go on. He measures that out. And I think this is a good example here that there are still 9 more coming. God could have just stopped here and let the time do what it's going to do, and Egypt ends up just withering. But He doesn't. Allows them to at least find some water, and then after 7 days, apparently returns the Nile back to water at some point. And He moves on to the next chastisement. And what we'll find is that each one of these times, there's opportunity at any point. Pharaoh could say, I've had enough, Lord. I've had enough. There's opportunity for repentance at any point along the way. Pharaoh just doesn't take it. But again, as I look at that, what I see is that God is compassionate. In fact, there's even a section we'll come up to here where when He brings one of the plagues against the animals, some of the Egyptians actually take their animals indoor, and it's because they were told, anything outside is going to get killed. And God permitted some of the Egyptians to take their animals indoor to protect their animals. They were able to escape the plague when they obeyed what He said, told Israel to do. And so, God is compassionate and merciful, even in the midst of His judgments. For our takeaway, I think it's pretty much the same thing. God's judgment is often accompanied by mercy and compassion. And can you think of 2 really big examples where God's judgment was pretty severe and yet there was compassion and mercy in it? I can think of one Old Testament one. You just nailed it. The flood. God could have wiped out everything. And He wiped out most of it. But He had compassion on Moses, on Noah and his family, and used them to then ultimately repopulate the earth. That was an act of compassion and mercy, not just on Noah, but on mankind, on the animals. Can you think of another really big one from the New Testament? It's the biggest one, the cross. Puts His Son on the cross. That's an act of severe judgment. But in the same breath, it's an act of extreme mercy, compassion, love. That's the way God is. His judgment, even in the Old Testament, when He judges Israel, we've seen this in the book of Judges, he's got to keep judging them, but He always relents. He always hears their prayers as they cry out. He always sends them a judge to rescue them from their enemies. Even when he takes them off into Babylonian captivity, what does he do? He sets a timetable. It's not going to be forever. I'm going to return you to the land. He gives them compassion and mercy in the midst of that judgment. Even when we think about the end times, what are we told? God is going to redeem the heart of Israel. There's always an act of mercy and compassion along with God's acts of judgment. And we see that here. And I think from a practical standpoint with us, you know, we're told that when we go to Christ and we confess our sins, it says that He's faithful and just and forgive us our sins, and then what? Purifies us full on of righteousness. This thought that we have to recognize that God, when He judges, when He disciplines, is also merciful and compassionate, ought to soften our hearts and say, you know what? I can go to Him. Because He's compassionate and mercy, and as I face His judgment or His chastisement, I can go to Him because He's merciful and compassionate. What an amazing thing. And so all of this, as we've seen this morning, God is looking at Pharaoh and He's saying, because you've done this, here's your consequences. Here's what I'm going to do. He starts off and He judges all these gods of the Egyptian Nile. He shows Pharaoh what he can do. He pours out the consequences of that. But even in the midst of that, He allows some counterfeit stuff to happen, which causes Pharaoh's heart to be hardened, which again serves as a warning for us. But then lastly, what we see in all of this is God, in the midst of this, is compassionate and merciful. And we're going to see that continue throughout all of these plagues. Amen?